All right. So, yes, again, welcome to everybody. The purpose of the call is to review the two proposal documents that have been circulated by a group on the list, one focusing on the Sunrise implementation and the other going through the claims process. So we have some members of the group that was involved in drafting those here on the call that will walk through those and take any questions and feedback on those. And we have the Adobe Connect available for any questions. You can raise your hand on that feature. If you're not on the Adobe Connect, you can just indicate verbally that you'd like to be put in the queue. And with that, I will hand it over to Jeff Newman. Jeff?
Thanks, Karen. Can everyone hear me? Hopefully it's phone work. Thank you, everyone, for showing up to this call. I really appreciate it. Chris Wright from ARI is not able, I don't think, to be on the call, so I'm going to walk through the documents from a high level. Jim Gould is on. Sharon from New Star is on. So there are some people here that won't get down into the technical details to answer the questions probably a lot better than I can. I know enough technical to be a tiny bit dangerous, but not... you know, some of the questions that were asked on the list and others, I think I may defer to Jim, Sharon, and some others that are on the call. Again, this is a proposal that a few of us worked on after the Brussels meeting. It's based on the earlier proposal that was submitted by ARI and New Star, and I want to thank the people that helped us on this one, the VeriSign team, Demand Media, and some others that took a look at it. And I also want to thank those that have commented on the list. Oh, seems like we have a little echo here. Right. So, and I'll try to get to some of those comments that were made on the list. I know Tom Barrett and Rubens had some great comments on there. I may not get to all of them, but we'll try to do our best. Okay. So what I thought I would do is go through the Sunrise document first, and then I would go through the claims document. I'm not going to get so much into the rationale because I think we spent the majority of our time in Brussels kind of talking through a lot of the rationale for all this. But if there are any questions on the rationale or as to why things were done in a certain way, then I have no problem going back and covering those as well. I just thought it would be a better use of our time to go through this. The goal then is to have this call this week, have another follow-up call next week, and then the ultimate goal is to get this document out to the community so that we can get feedback from, you know, rights holders from other parties, registrants and registrars that haven't participated on this list so that we can have a really fruitful discussion in Toronto and hopefully come to closure. I think there are some people from the providers, from Deloitte and IBM on here as well. Great. So if any of them have comments, would love to hear those as well. Obviously, a good deal of this is dependent on what you guys are able to do. And so obviously, to the extent you guys have comments, please make sure you speak up and get those on the list so we can address those as possible. Sounds like someone's typing pretty loudly, so if everyone could mute their phones, that'd be great. Okay, so with the Sunrise, just in general, kind of walking through it, you know, we wanted to develop a solution that would work regardless of whether you did a first come, first serve Sunrise or whether you did a non-real time Sunrise where, let's say, you were collecting applications in a batch and then processing them if there were multiple applications. You have some sort of contention process, whether that's an auction or whether that's some sort of priority right based on jurisdiction, as I know was an example that was mentioned. And so we tried to keep all of those models in mind. You know, we tried to think of everyone that we knew of or you can think of, but obviously if there are any scenarios that you all were or you know of or that you were going to implement that this may not cover, you know, let us know that as well. Okay. So the first thing is that the general Sunrise model that we built is based, as we discussed in Brussels, on maintaining a global public-private key pair and providing the public key to the registrars and the registries. You know, at a very high level, we're not going to go into how the Trademark Clearinghouse does its authentication and validation of the trademarks that get into the clearinghouse. We're just making the assumption that all of that's done, and that's done according to the way in the guidebook and any other discussions that have taken place. But once that information, once the Trademark Clearinghouse has authenticated the trademark information that's provided by the trademark holder and validated all the use requirements for eligibility, at least according to the guidebook, then the Trademark Clearinghouse would sign the Sunrise, the trademark data, with its private key. And then the digitally signed information is referred to, we refer to it as the signed mark data. So that's another thing. There's a bunch of new terms that we introduce here and abbreviation. So if you kind of get lost or whatever, just raise your hand and we'll try to go over it. So that signed mark data, that signed file is then provided to the mark holder. And typically this would be in the form of a file download from the Trademark Clearinghouse website. I see that Carl's got a question. So I'll take questions as I go out if you raise your hand. So Carl, if you have a question. You may be on mute, Carl. Okay, well, I guess we'll come back to Carl if he is able to get the phone line fixed. So as each top-level domain begins their sunrise, then, you know, the mark holder is going to select its registrar as it would do a normal registration and would provide that registrar with its signed mark data as part of its application for a name within the applicable sunrise period. And the registrar, caused a couple comments on the list, so I'll cover it in a little more detail. But the registrar or its reseller has the ability, if it chooses to validate information using the TMCH, the public key, and then forwarding that information once it's assured that the information is correct to the registry to create the application. This is not this is completely voluntary by the registrar. And it's simply if the registrar wants to make sure that the application is going to go through, it's just easier for the registrar since they have the relationship with the registrant to kind of work out any problems that they might have early on before submitting that data to the registry and then finding out from the registry that there's something wrong with the information that's submitted. So it's voluntary, and it's not meant to be a substitute for validating or authenticating the trademark information. It's simply to make sure that everything in the application is there and ready to be forwarded on to the registry. So I'm trying to read the comments on the chat as well. It's kind of tough to do, but if I miss anything, just speak up or raise your hand. Okay, so then once the registry gets the information, gets the signature of the signed mark data with the public key and verifies that the domain matches we use the term labels here, and I know that kind of caused some issues, so I'm trying to go and address the comments. But essentially, you're going to make sure that the domain matches what's being registered, the trademark string matches what's being registered. Then it says, and this comment again raised some questions, the registry may also verify any other information in the SMD, in the signed mark data, to ensure it's consistent with the registry's Sunrise eligibility policies, and then the application or domain name is created. This, again, is not meant for the registry to validate the actual trademark data itself that the Trademark Clearinghouse has done, but really is there so that the registry can, if it's got additional eligibility requirements, let's say it's by jurisdiction, you know, so it wants to limit its applications because its normal policies are limited to a specific geographic territory, or it wants to give priority based on certain classes of goods and services, or whatever else is in the trademark file that the registry has proposed to use. It's really for the registry to do that as a, and to validate the signature. It's not really for the registry to do anything other than that. And I don't know if that caused some confusion on the list or not. Okay? Then, and this is all the high-level stuff, and we'll get into some more detail, but at the closure of the sunrise round, the registry operator will then make its allocations. Again, that could be first come, first serve. That could be batch process through auction. It could be, you know, you name it. There's probably a million different ways it can be done. And then we coined a new term called the notification of registered names notices, which we the abbreviation is NORN. Sorry for the abbreviations, but the registry will notify the clearinghouse of the registered domain names for the purpose of notifying matching mark holders about the fact that there was a name registered that matches their mark, and as well as for reporting purposes. So these are notices that are going to be provided, or it's going to be a file provided by the registry to the clearinghouse, and then the clearinghouse will send out the notices. And it was our belief, and again, we can take comments on it, but it's our belief that a daily upload of these registered names would be sufficient for the clearinghouse to generate these notices. Again, that's up for discussion. So that's kind of the overall detail, in very general terms. And then I thought I would just point out a couple things that were in the kind of more detailed sections of it, and, you know, kind of talk about that. You know, the change in this model versus the ICANN model is the use of PKI, and we talked about that in Brussels. We think that the decoupling of the trademark clearinghouse and registry system simplifies the overall structure and allows support scenarios where, you know, registry could extend the sunrise period without too much difficulty, or it could also provide ways for those that may have not been present in the clearinghouse when the sunrise started to, you know, to update the clearinghouse and then to be able to participate by the end of the sunrise period. Whereas it seemed like in the model that was initially proposed, there has to be some effective date that was set prior to the beginning of sunrise, and then it just seemed like it was very difficult to include new information after the sunrise period had started. It seems like this method that we proposed addresses those issues. And then in the document, just like we did in the claims document as well, we go through certain security scenarios that are there in any kind of PKI situation, and we don't think any of these scenarios are really likely, but we do have solutions if they were to occur. So one obvious thing, for example, is that, you know, what if the private key or the public key, what if there's some compromise of it? Again, very, very unlikely, but if there was some sort of key compromise, then under the system it would be fairly easy for the clearinghouse to create a new public key, and all previously signed files with the old key would then have to go back to the clearinghouse to get re-signed. The registry would know this because it would receive the file, and it would know it was signed with the old key, and then it could provide instructions back to the registrar to make sure that the trademark holder goes back to the clearinghouse to get their the signed mark data. Sorry, I'm just looking. Tom is there? Okay, Tom just put in another benefit in there. If you guys wanna say this stuff, just raise your hand. Otherwise, I'll just let the chat stand as it is. If there are mistakes in the signed data, so that, you know, something's wrong with the file, then just like in any kind of certificate revocation, there'd be a signed mark data revocation list that would be checked by the registries to make sure that the signed file has not been revoked. And then if there was a compromise of the signed data where, let's say, an entity, any signed data was retrieved by another third party and the third party tried to use that signed data as their own, we think this is also pretty rare, and it also relies on the trademark holder keeping their information secret, or, you know, keeping their signed file. But the worst that would happen in a situation would be that a third party has really registered the name on behalf of the trademark owner. So if there was some this quick dispute mechanism that was created, you know, essentially the name would be taken away from the third party that registered it and given to the actual trademark owner that was listed, you know, whose signed mark data was actually used. So we don't think this is really likely to occur. Just as kind of a editorial, we did this in .us because at that time, you know, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office didn't have a record of email addresses. So in theory, it was possible for someone to just copy the trademark information from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, but put their own email address and ultimately end up with a name. But our dispute policy was such that if the actual trademark owner came and disputed it, then we said thank you to the third party for registering on the trademark holder's behalf and just took it away from the third party and gave it to the trademark owner since it was their data that was used. Okay, so going into the elements of the signed mark data, we took this from the guidebook, and I think this still has to be kind of finalized, but you know, we think that there should be a serial number to identify the data for support and revocation purposes. We think that there should be a validity period that's set by the Trademark Clearinghouse so that, you know, the signed mark data can only be used for a certain period of time, maybe that's a year. Whatever the Trademark Clearinghouse policy is on renewing the information that's in the clearinghouse, so there should be some finite period that the signed file is good for. And I'll get to Tom in a second. The trademark information we think should be in there, and this is one of those questions in section 2.3. It's the fourth bullet that's up on Adobe right now. That needs to be discussed as to what the exact trademark information that needs to be in there. We kind of shorthanded it, but again, this is just what we thought would be in there. And then, of course, the owner information, such as the organization name and address. This would be based on the EPP contact fields, and this is to be used as the registrant contact data. So this is where some information, the question came up on the list, and I think merits some discussion, which is, does the trademark owner have to match the registrant? So does there have to be an exact match between the registrant of the domain name during a sunrise and the entity that's listed as the trademark owner? I know there's a bunch of issues that were brought up with, you know, trademarks can have an owner but then be assigned. There could be licensees. So I think we do need to talk about that here, but we also need to talk about that, I think, with the rights holders to figure out how that works. And then, of course, there'd be a digital signature generated over all the data using the clearinghouse private key. And so let me go to Tom. Tom, are you on mute?
Yeah, hi, Jeff. It's Tom.
Hey, Tom.
I just thought it would be interesting to get some responses regarding the question on whether or not the Sunrise registrant needs to match the validated trademark owner, if people have any comments on that.
Okay, thanks, Tom. And Jonathan, are you in the queue for that question?
Yeah, Jeff, hi. I think my immediate response would be I would think that we can introduce quite a lot of complication if it isn't the registered trademark owner or beneficial owner that is the ultimate registrant, and I would expect that the ownership data would be what we would expect the Trademark Clearinghouse to verify or validate, and on the basis of what was validated, that we could only register the Sunrise name to that validated party. But if I'd like to understand the argument for A, why we wouldn't do that, and B, how practically we might register it to another entity. And by that, I'm not ruling out the possibility of registering it to, for example, the licensee if the Trademark Clearinghouse had validated that the licensee was indeed the beneficial owner. Thanks, Jeff.
So, Jonathan, are you suggesting that maybe there's another field that's collected by the clearinghouse that has what you're calling kind of the beneficial owner, and that could be the assignee or a licensee or You know, obviously that's to be worked out between the trademark owner and the beneficial owner, but there still should be some sort of match with the file, whether it's a match to the beneficial owner or a match to the trademark owner.
Correct. Ultimately, the registry, I believe, should only be registering it to a party that has been validated by the clearinghouse. Now, whether we stick to that being only the trademark owner or encompass licensees, which I would expect we would do, licensees and assignees, which is what I'm loosely referring to as the beneficial owner in this case. But in any event, I would think it would be very difficult for the registry to register the Sunrise name to anyone, any party other than one which had been validated by the Trademark Clearinghouse.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Jonathan. And I think Carl's got a comment in there about you could have multiple beneficial owners depending on regions. And I think absolutely, Carl, that's absolutely right. I think but I think that has to be worked on. There has to be some dispute policy, or that has to be really an issue that's worked out between the trademark owner and the beneficial owners. It's kind of hard to put the clearinghouse in the middle of that. Or certainly the registries or registrars, certainly that has to be worked out through the parties themselves. I'm not sure there's anything that we can do to kind of accommodate that. Bill, do you have a comment as well? William?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I couldn't find a mute button. I just wanted to observe, I think there may have been some miscommunication about how Sunrise codes work and whether or not and exactly what the delays are going to look like if a rights holder were to come to the clearinghouse, say, late in the process with respect to when a Sunrise begins. I really think that the dominant factor in timing is not going to be the delivery of service codes or the signing of data, which is going to be a fairly insignificant timing factor in either the PKI model that you proposed or the ICANN model that was published on June 28th, because the dominant factor is going to be how long it takes to verify the information provided by the rights holder. And that's going to take, right now we're thinking that's going to take like a week. That's a substantial amount of time, and I think that that's probably the dominant factor. Adding an hour or making the code distribution instantaneous via PKI does not seem to be the dominant factor or even a particularly powerful factor in considering the timing.
Okay. I'm going to go. Does anybody have any comments on that or responses? Okay. And I'm trying to catch up on some of the comments in the chat as well. I think that's – so one of the questions we definitely need to – and we can talk about it here about the information matching, but I think that information is really going to be – I really think we need input from the rights holders on this question, because it's really more of a policy question as opposed to a technical solution, unless anyone – disagrees with that, and we can highlight that as kind of an item that needs to be discussed more thoroughly in the community. Jim?
Yeah, I think the question related to matching of the owner information to the registrant applies to both models. So this is a fundamental question that will help us determine which model will suit or whether or not the ICANN model will be able to serve the requirements. So, we really need to get an answer to that question.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that's a good point. It applies to both the Sunrise and the claims, and it's not really addressed at all in the guidebook. So you're right. This is one of those areas that is so important that we do need some uniformity amongst all of the amongst all the registries and registrars and the clearinghouse, so that it's not left for interpretation for each of the registries, and they'll all do it differently, and that'll just cause mass confusion in the marketplace. So this is one of those that I view as a critical item to work through. One of the other things I kind of wanted to talk through on this model And it's something that I see was addressed. I think Werner had a comment on it in the chat, which is that this model enables registries to do what they've done in the past, which is to include, if they choose, some information on a trademark in the whois, so that, you know, later on registrants or the community could look in the whois and see some of the trademark information in the registry's actual whois, to know that that mark was taken during sunrise, and to see the information behind why it got a first right to get those names during that period. So I know this is something that not only, you know, it was something initially requested by trademark owners back in 2001 when we first were doing the sunrises, and subsequent sunrises has been implemented. It enables kind of a support mechanism as well, so that the registries don't have to get a call every single time. You know, there's a disgruntled registrant that believes that they were there first, or a registrar that believes that it submitted applications first and wondering why someone else was awarded the name. So I think, I'm not sure, and maybe William, this way makes it much easier, since it's information provided by the trademark owner directly to the registry. It's not coming to the registry through some sort of download from the clearinghouse. But it's information that will be displayed in the whois, and there has not been a privacy or security complaint about these being done in the past. Again, this is something that probably we need feedback from the community on, but it is public trademark information that was sent to the registry for the purpose of registering the domain name. So I think that's kind of an important point for those that have done it. And I think Jonathan just showed an example. Thanks, Jonathan. You put an example in the chat room. So that's the information that was displayed. Is that for Triple S, Jonathan, or is that for...
Dot Asia, Jeff.
Oh, there's Dot Asia. Thanks, Jonathan. So, yeah, so it's been done before, and I think, I'm not sure, it seems very difficult to do that under the Deloitte model, but this way certainly makes it much easier to do. And Rubens has a comment. He said the trademark information on whois can be of concern with topical domains that have searchable whois. Can you, Rubens, are you saying that it's just more difficult, it's more coding around the searchability if you want to create searchable fields using the trademark information, or is there something else I'm missing? I don't know if Rubens can, maybe he's typing it in. Okay, same as issue with the trademark data itself. Okay, so again, I think this is going to go out to the community. I don't, you know, when we were walking through this model, we didn't think that, again, there would be any privacy or security implications of this. But, you know, the true test will be putting it out there for the rights holders to comment on. Is there anything else with one of the other benefits we thought this could be used for is that the signed mark data could be used, even though this is not in the guidebook, although it was initially in very early on when we were talking about all the rights protection mechanisms. For a long period of time, it was talked about that the URS would use the clearinghouse, use the information, trademark information, to validate the information during the URS proceeding. Because if you think about a U.S. proceeding, just like a UDRP, one of the elements is to show that the trademark owner actually has rights in the name that it's contesting. And an easy way to do that would be bumping up against the clearinghouse to check that information. For some reason, it didn't make it through the later versions of the guidebook. I'm not sure what happened there and when that came out, but it did come out. But we think that something like that would be a benefit to the intellectual property holders, so a signed mark data file could be used to in the URS to show that this information has been validated by the clearinghouse. We think that's another benefit. Again, it wasn't in the guidebook, at least the latest versions of it, but it was something that we know was in there previously. OK, Okay. Anything else with respect to Sunrise that we missed or issues that you think we need to point out for comment from the community? William, if you have any additional comments or concerns about this, I know that you've had a few weeks now with and Deloitte, you've had a few weeks to think about this, and I don't know if there's any additional comments or whether this, it seems like this is a feasible model for the clearinghouse. There's a question from, while we wait for that, a question from Jim. During the presentation, talked about the brand going to their registrar. This assumes they have a corporate brand registrar, such as Dark Modern, Melbourne IT, etc. What's the impact for either model in a situation where a brand's preferred registrar is not an accredited registrar for one or more new GTLDs? This could happen as part of the LRA. I think it's an interesting question, Jim. I'd like to hear from registrars on that. I think this is a model that not only corporate registrars were, Demand Media had looked at it from their perspective, and they think this is something that they could do. But I know that there are some registries that either have a single registrant or single registrar model, assuming it gets through the code of conduct analysis, and there may be new registrars created. I think it's incumbent upon us to make this easily understood by anyone that chooses to be a registrar. So once this model is finalized, I think there's going to have to be a bunch of really good FAQs, demonstrations, and others to enable these registrars to be able to do it. I think it's a good question. It's one I don't have necessarily an answer for, but maybe others do. So I'm just looking at the next. Vicki, you have a comment?
Actually, I have a question. With the sign mark data file, how does it work when a trademark information changes? For example, a trademark is no longer registered, so there's no update of that file as such. How would you believe that would be implemented? Or trademark holders change? A trademark can change from trademark holder to another trademark holder.
Okay, that's a good question, and I'm going to also ask for help from Jim if he wants to help out with that, but I think that can sort of be handled with a revocation list. It's sort of in the same way. I know it's not a mistake, it's really an update, but if there's a change in the information behind the signed file, I would think that would just be added to the revocation list, and then a new certificate issued, or a new signed mark data file issued for that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jeff, is the fact that, especially if the mark holder is the one that is making the update, they have a signed, the signed data that is inaccurate and they want to get it updated, pretty much that could automatically go to the revocation list, the old one, and then you get a new signed mark, right, that you could use subsequently.
Right. And I think this is similar even to the, in Vicki and the Deloitte model, right, because if there was a code that was at one point good, that code would then, in essence, be revoked if there were changes to it and a new code issued. So I think it's fairly similar, but maybe I'm misinterpreting that. Vicki, did you want to follow up on that, or William? Let me throw it over to you because I could have just been fading, so you're probably going to figure that out.
because the code, the Sunrise code contains less data, it's less subject to changes in ownership, contact data, and the like that is likely to change over the lifespan of a registration in our current estimation. So I think that the codes are less likely to need to change. They only need to change if the mark goes to a different completely leaves the clearinghouse, goes to a different owner, and by different owners, not the email address changes, not the mailing address changes, just the owner. Or a mark of that. That's when codes have to change, or if there's some other rotational reason like security. I think that the PKI model.
There's something related to the requirement around the owner matching the registrant that might play into this as well, right? So if that becomes a driving requirement, you know, I'm not sure how the code mechanism would work where the registries would now have to have the owner information, right? So the thing is that fundamentally the registries need the information for the validation. So if the mark holder makes changes and they want that reflected and taken into account by the registries, then you would need to somehow support that.
Right. I'm not here to engage in a pro-con discussion, but I will agree that if the requirement is that we provide additional information during the Sunrise process, then there's going to need to be some mechanism added because that's currently not supported in the ICANN model.
Okay, thanks. On the connection between the clearinghouse and the URS, there were some comments on the chat about, you know, they were intentionally kept separate, and also the comment that if it's to be used for URS, then the clearinghouse would be an ongoing model, would essentially have to live forever. I think that's right. I think, frankly, the clearinghouse is going to have to live for a long period of time anyway, simply because of the, you know, that there's not just going to be one round. I mean, round one is going to be spread out amongst probably a several-year period, and then there'll be round two anyway. So I think the clearinghouse, whether we like it or not, is probably an entity that's going to live forever, whether that's through the current providers only or it subsequently gets moved to a new provider. I think, again, this is my own kind of reading of the tea leaves, but I think the clearinghouse is something we're going to be stuck with for as long as we have registries. But again, that's my own opinion. I could be completely wrong, but it just seems like we're heading down that path anyway. Can you have your hand still raised, or is that...
No, that's Jan. Sorry here. It's Jan Korsten.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, so I wanted to add one thing. Jeff, you raised it already, that from a privacy perspective, obviously, there needs to be still an additional discussion. We had some preliminary discussions with our specialists, and what is definitely clear is that the clearinghouse is a database of data, and even though the individual components of that are publicly available, most of it is publicly available, because it is included in a database, it automatically falls under the privacy laws, and thus also the new directives that are coming up here in Europe, which are also derived from the U.S. ones. So if instead of a code we are going to give, or the clearinghouse is going to give data that is coming out of that database, by falling under the obligations, of which I'm not saying that they can't be overcome whatsoever, but the consequence of that will probably be that some of the legal obligations that we have on that data, we will have to pass on to whoever is receiving that data. What that in detail is, I'm still waiting to have a detailed view on that, but that is definitely going to be a difference between providing a code and providing actual data out of the database. Again, I'm not saying that whatever those legal obligations are can't be overcome, but whoever is then receiving data from it will also have to accept them.
Okay, I think that's fair. I mean, you know, consent usually is something, informed consent to that data being shared is something that usually can override, and but certainly you're right, the obligations for maintaining the that information, you know, obviously is something that we could discuss, but I certainly think it is workable. There are plenty of European databases and data that comes out of Europe into other countries, either through safe harbor provisions or through contractual clauses agreements. So I do think that I understand the privacy, but one of the things I'm a little bit, I mean, maybe when we get into talking about the claims, I hear what you're saying on Sunrise, but then how could you justify a proposed model where you guys have it basically giving all the information, even in encrypted form, to the registries and registrars through the decentralized model for the claims. I think it's the same issue. Regardless of how it's done, maybe for the two different things, but you're right, obligations will need to be understood and passed through, and I do think that's something that can be overcome. In either model, I think it's going to be an issue.
And isn't that just being given back to the mark holder as well? I mean, is the Trademark Clearinghouse modifying any of the data, but you're pretty much taking the data from the mark holder, verifying it, and then giving it back to them, right?
And yeah, I mean, essentially that's it, yeah.
So I'm not sure what additional data that you're divulging in doing so.
The majority of the data most likely is going to go through the registrar, I would assume, or through the agents.
That's the mark holder passing that on, right? They would have to pass it no matter what if they didn't have the signed mark, right?
Yes, but according to, again, I'm not a privacy specialist myself, and so I definitely support the fact of having done an additional, let's say, some additional research on this. Even though it comes from them, because of the fact that you put this in a database and it becomes a database, you fall under restricted privacy laws. That's what's been told to us.
So I don't think we should get into a privacy debate here because I think none of us are really truly experts on it, but I think we should note the issue and we should have more work done on it under either model. But even if this were a privacy issue, like Jan said earlier, it can be overcome. We just need to figure out how that works and move on from there. I think it's an issue we need to work on regardless of whether we do it through the PKI model or through the model that was proposed by Deloitte. If not for Sunrise, we certainly need to work through it for claims. All that said is that are we ready to go on to the claims? Oh, I'm sorry. Jonathan, you have a comment?
Yeah, just a couple of comments. It's Jonathan speaking. First of all, on the privacy thing, I think, Jan's absolutely right to flag this. I agree. We don't want to get into a debate now, but we should bear in mind that data is being passed. We're putting it into a database. We're potentially transmitting it into Whois, which is something we touched on a few minutes ago. We may or may not do. We'll certainly be transmitting it out into IP claims, which we'll obviously come on to. So we are no doubt collating, reorganizing, and transmitting data. So whilst we can't resolve that issue now, I think it's absolutely right that it's on the table and we understand the laws and issues with that. Going back to a previous point, which was on multiple registrars, I mean, I think we're about to enter into a new and unique system that we haven't, in a way in which we haven't worked with before. Let me give you an example. I think it's very possible that there will be certain agents who input data into the clearinghouse who have no connection necessarily with the domain name registration industry. In other words, some entities may want to simply secure a registration in the clearinghouse without wanting to go on to participate in Sunrise, so may not need a registrar at all. There are others who might, there are other examples I can think of where there might be a requirement to have multiple registrars, potentially, or at least a mechanism if a registry was going to run a first-come-first-served Sunrise. So there are examples certainly where a registrar will be required. It may not be the same entity as that which puts in the data. There'll be other examples where there is no registrar required, and there may be examples where there are more than one registrar required. So I think that's an issue that may need a little bit more work. So I just wanted to flag that because it came up by that point raised in the chat, and we touched on it briefly, but I wanted to emphasize some scenarios around which, the implementation will need to perhaps handle those cases. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jonathan. Karen, you have a comment?
Sure. Thank you, Jeff. I just wanted to speak a little bit on the question about whether there's a required matching between the say the contact information in the clearinghouse record and the what goes into the Whois in terms of the domain registration, and that's a question that we've discussed on the team as well. And I just wanted to share with you a little bit of the discussion that we had on that. You know, that we haven't put that out as a requirement, you know, as far as you know, any of the discussions or you know, documentation in the guidebook. You know, that doesn't appear that that's a requirement. It's certainly something that registries could do, but others can speak to this, but I don't have the understanding that, you know, in previous registry sunrises where trademark data has been used, that there's been a requirement that, you know, the fields kind of line up between all of them. And we thought it was, as I think has been alluded to on the list, that it'd be difficult to do a one-to-one matching because the fields, you know, collected by the clearinghouse are not going to, you know, line up exactly with the ones that the registry collects. So, and then it seemed like, there hasn't been a limitation in terms of, you know, who a rights holder may choose to use or authorize or act. So it seemed to like it would create potentially more confusion or you know, frustration if you was a set as a universal requirement for everybody. So that was just to put that out there. Thanks.
Yeah, I think Ken, it's a really good point. It's tough to do matches, exact matches as well. But couldn't that information be used in a later dispute? So if there was some sort of dispute with who got the name, if there's not a match, that certainly would help. And I don't mean an exact match character by character without ampersands and, you know, all that other kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about, you know, it's used later on, and if there were a dispute over the ownership of the name, certainly one manually looking at it during a dispute would see, yes, it's not an exact match because there's one character that's off, but the entities are completely different. So I think we need to be careful, too, of setting up instances where we can create a mechanism for fraud. So simply maybe not doing the matching from a technical perspective, but having the requirements there so that if there's a dispute, it can be taken away if there was ever a case of fraud or abuse. Jonathan?
Thanks, Jeff. I responded a little bit to what Karen said. I mean, I do worry about not having a match, although I hear what you've just said a moment ago about what's a practical suggestion to that. The challenge is clearly using another's mark to gain a different entity's domain name. I mean, that's the issue. If they don't match, I as one entity can use another's mark to secure the domain name of choice, and it may go unnoticed. I think Karen touched on the issue of the agent entering the data into, I think I heard her talk about the agent entering the data into the clearinghouse. Clearly that's a completely different issue altogether. The mark owner may authorize an agent to do so, and in fact what it does do is if we had the requirement for matching, it would mean there would be no motivation for anyone other than someone who is working on behalf of the mark owner to enter data into the clearinghouse. If the matching wasn't required, we may create a motivation for all sorts of people to simply secure trademark data and enter it into the clearinghouse on the basis of potentially securing names that go unnoticed, at least for a period of time. So I would caution strongly against having no requirement to match. I hear what you said. Yours was a practical rules-based approach. But I'd be tempted to go even further if it was technically feasible and ensure that the actual data was used to write into the domain name record. Thanks.
Thanks, Jonathan. Okay, any other questions on the sunrise, or should we move on to claims, which is actually probably the more difficult one anyway, and there are still more questions with the claims that we need to at least raise and go into, and maybe go into more detail on the next call. So So for the trademark claims, and I know the document's going to be put up there in a second, the proposed model is that we have actually breaks the claims process into two different questions, and we started to go through this in Brussels, but it really breaks the question into does a claim exist for this DNS label, and really that's the string. And I know that was pointed out, I think, by Tom or someone else on the list, so we'll fix that. If the answer is yes, then give me the claims notice for that that string. And so by doing that, you know, it mitigates some of the issues with having a centralized provider. So the solution, again, that Deloitte has proposed is really a decentralized model where it pushed the pretty much entire copies of the database in an encrypted form to the registries and registrars. We talked about this at length as to whether we thought that encryption, you know, whether that really essentially in most of our minds, no matter how it's encrypted, all of those, there's ways to break that encryption fairly easily, and there, you know, all of that data, basically giving the entire database to the registries and registrars, presents a bunch of security and privacy issues, at least from our perspective. So keeping that in mind, also understanding the pushback with the centralized model that Kurt had expressed and others about putting the clearinghouse in the direct or the critical path of registration. Obviously, that's something that we have to figure out ways to live with if we're going to use that model. And so we proposed some sort of mitigation steps in here, but this is all out for discussion. So essentially in this process, at a very high level, the clearinghouse would periodically publish a list of just the strings that are known to match trademarks in the clearinghouse. Again, it's just the strings. It's not information about who owns them. It's not information about what class of goods and services they are. It's just that information. We understand there were some issues raised or some potential issues. People thought that may raise some privacy issues. I've had some discussions with some trademark owners, and initially their gut reaction was that it wouldn't necessarily raise these issues if all you're releasing are the strings. But again, it's a question that we need to put out to rights holders in general and also look at the privacy implications. So essentially, this list would have the list would include all of the strings that were registered in the clearinghouse, and registries could download that list and use it in their registration systems to answer basically the question of whether a claim exists for that string. The potential registrar would then approach the registrar, just as it normally would for a normal registration, to register the domain name or submit an application. The reason we use these different terminologies is the guidebook says, and correct me if I'm wrong, Karen, if I'm not using the exact words, but essentially the guidebook says that the claim service must be running during the first, at least the first 60 days of general registration, I think, or general availability. General availability could be done in a number of different ways. As we talked about in Brussels, there could be auctions, there could be first come, first serve, it could be some sort of other priority mechanism. I mean, there's a whole bunch of ways that general availability could be done. And so whatever method we develop has to work with all of those. And this will get into a question that later on that we'll get into as far as timing of when a claim needs to be checked. So I'm going to put that on the back burner for now, although it was definitely discussed a lot on the list. So the registrant and the registrar can check to see if the name's available using normal EPP check mechanism. Then once the registrant has identified the name that they would like the registrar, and the registrar could also employ tools like NameSpinner and others. Some registrars do for, you know, generic names. Once the registrar has identified that the name they would like to, the registrar would then use a new EPP command, which there's already a spec that's out there that's trying to address this. Check with the registry if the domain matches the claimed mark. The registry will then check to see if the label's present on the list that they've downloaded. If there is a match, then the registry returns a unique string to the registrar. It's in the form of a URL, and the process would continue on. If there's no match, then it's just a normal registration or normal application, depending on what stage it's in that land rush process. The registrar now has a unique string, if there's a match, that they'll need to use to do an HTTP query. And then we've created two new terms here. We have a claims notice information service. So the registrar would obtain the claims notice content from the claims notice info service using HTTP protocol. As part of getting this information, the registrar provides the unique string obtained from the previous step and as well as the complete domain name being registered and applied for. Then the signed claims notice signature. So then the clearinghouse would return the claims notice information accompanied with a signed claims notice signature. We abbreviate that with SCNS. That's digitally signed using the TMCH private key. The SCNS would include a timestamp of when it was of the validity period that the clearinghouse says, you know, this is valid from X date to Y date. And then the complete domain name used in the CNIS request. And then the SCNS, the signed claims notice signature, can be used by the registrar with a subsequent domain create command and then can be validated by the registry. I know that's a mouthful and a lot of abbreviations. We will go into that in more detail. So the next step, and I think Jeff Heckhouse had pointed this out on the list, there's still a lot of information or a lot of details that need to be worked out in how registrars present the information and whether there should be a uniform approach. But I think this will go a long way into assisting that discussion. So then the registrar will need to read and accept the claims notice. The registrar would then send the create command to the registry to create the domain name. This command will include the SCNS, the signed claims notice signature. That must have been obtained by the clearinghouse. The command will also include the details of who accepted the notice in the form of basically the IP address, the client IP address, and a timestamp of when the notice is accepted. We'll talk about why all of this information is in there in a moment. The registry would then verify whether or not the string is subject to a claim. If so, is the signed claim, the SCNS, the signed claims notice signature present? If it's not required because it didn't match, then the name's registered as normal. If the signature is present, then would use the Trademark Clearinghouse's public key, cross-check that the domain name being created. If there's a match, then the registration will succeed. If there's not a match, it will fail. The registry records the identifier in the SCNS and along with the client IP address and the timestamp. Now, all of that could be used for support later on. And then just like there was in the Sunrise, there would be the concept of this, the NORN notices. I'll go back to the abbreviation stands for the notification of registered name notice. This notice would be a little bit different than the Sunrise, but it's the same basic concept where the registry would notify the clearinghouse, presumably daily, of the registered domain names for the purpose of notifying mark holders, or I should say matching mark holders, about the fact that the domain name was registered. And the notices would include the identifier from the SCNS. The combination of the domain name and the SCNS identifier could be used to trace the claims notice end-to-end, so from the clearinghouse registrar to the registry. And this could be done, a daily upload of registered names to the clearinghouse, we think, would be sufficient. So I know I've walked you very quickly. We can get into a little bit more detail, but that's the general process. The list of marks that we published, again, by the clearinghouse for the step one, which is to check to see if a name exists, would include the string, which we call the DNS label here, but again, I think the comment was raised, so we'll change the terminology. And then the random unique string needed to retrieve the claims notice, that's in the form of a URL. And so there's an example, I think, in the document a little bit later on of what that string could look like. There's some more detail, technical detail. I think what I'll go to is the information in the signed claim noted signature. So I think that's, I don't have control over the document, but I think it's 3.2 or 3.3, if you scroll down. Yeah, I'm skipping the use of PKI. Wait, am I? Hold on, let me just see if I'm going to cover that in a second. Yeah, I'm skipping just for now the PKI section, the use of PKI, and going to, 3.4. So this is, again, kind of what we thought should be in the signed claims notice signature, which is the identifier that would be unique, generated by the clearing house, the timestamp of when the information was generated to enable a registry to tell when the claims notice was generated, and prevent reuse of the signed claims data, ensuring that the notice was specific for this domain name registration. The fully qualified domain name that is the SCNS is for, and a big digital signature generated over all of the SCNS data with the that's signed with the Trademark Clearing House private key. So I think that's pretty self-explanatory. And the notice, the NOR notice, again, I think we... what should be in that is the SCNS identifier, the domain name, and the creation timestamp. So going into some of the benefits, we think this protects the trademark information against data mining better than the Deloitte solution at this point. The URLs are not predictable. The Trademark Clearing House can see all of the requests for claims notices and can monitor. It can rate limit or whatever else it deems necessary to protect the data, and data is centralized only at the clearinghouse, so access is known and controlled by them. It allows registrars who have the relationship, the customer relationship, to provide feedback to potential registrars immediately, especially when they check domain names across multiple PLDs. We think it's technically efficient, simple to implement, and it's auditable. Now, the real difficult section is the section that we call requirements for the clearinghouse. I think it's section 5. This is where a lot of the discussion, I think, needs to be had, especially with the providers, because this is so fundamentally a different model than what was proposed and requires a much more highly available system. And we've come out with ways that we think we could mitigate some of the potential issues if the clearinghouse goes down. But that's still not a substitute for high availability requirements. And I want to just stress that even though we have some mitigation in here, there's still an expectation that the clearinghouse will be extremely highly available and should take the steps that we think are reasonable to take for any provider of this type of service. So we think it's the other than the issue of being highly available, we think the actual service itself is relatively simple to implement. We think that separating the questions of matching the claim matching the claim from providing the information allows registries to control a lot of the process, because we did an estimate. Of course, it's a guess, but looking at .biz that implemented an IP claim service back in 2000. Again, times have changed, but it was our estimate that maybe 10 to 15% of the names that were applied for during the first 60 days were actually subject to a claim. So, we could be off by a degree. It could be 20%, it could be 30% in the future. But still, we still believe that a majority of the registrations during Land Rush will not have a claim associated with it. But we could be wrong, but that's kind of the assumption using past data. Given that, separating the question of whether something matches a claim from providing the info, if the registries have the information of whether it matches, even if the clearinghouse is down, the registry will know whether there's a claim. if there's not a claim, the registry can then still process the registration, which we think will be 70 to 80% of the registrations during land rush. If there is a claim and the clearinghouse is down, that's what we need to talk about. And from our perspective in writing the paper, and again, this is something we seek feedback on, is that it's an acceptable risk to not allow those registrations to go through until the clearinghouse is up, if the clearinghouse has taken reasonable measures to make sure it's highly available. So if the clearinghouse, for example, has redundancy or has, another hot site or has is able to live up to strict and is able to live up to strict SLAs, whether it's financial penalties for failing to meet the SLAs, if there's the reasonable steps that we all take as providers of services, we think there's an acceptable risk for of the clearinghouse going down. We also think that there should be things like potentially a backup provider or escrow of the data, so that if another provider needs to be brought on board, it could be done fairly quickly. So there's things in there. But again, we all as registries have to be comfortable with the notion of if the clearinghouse goes down and it matches a claim, that we do not proceed with the registration of those names because of the guidebook requirement that every string that's registered in the first 60 days, if there's a match, has to go through the claims process. I know that's a lot to swallow. I know it's not easy, but the alternative to allow those registrations to occur, I think, would violate the spirit of the guidebook, and I know we would get some strong pushback from the trademark owners that have filed the claims. David, you have a question?
Yeah, sorry, Jeff. I had to unmute my phone. Yeah, I'm worried that position about when the trademark clearinghouse is down, that we do not let the registration proceed is a little too extreme. The conversations I've had led me to believe that this is an area where, a reasonable compromise is available. What if instead of simply, blocking the registrant from going any further, what we're able to do as a registry is simply put those registrations that have gone through on some type of hold, and then require that registrant to then do some active affirmation that they've received the claims notice after the clearinghouses come back up.
So we could discuss that, I think, amongst the small group of gyms in the queue, but we just thought that was allowing after the fact validations was something that we thought would in the past, a retroactive acceptance of those types of criteria, if they come from the registry, would either be the registrant would either ignore it, would never get it, would go into the spam filter. We could talk about ways to do that. We just didn't think that was necessarily something. The guidebook is pretty clear. It says that a registration can't go through if there's been no acceptance. But I think we could talk about it. And Jim, I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, just one thing is clarifying the availability of the TMCH. I mean, we're not talking about the TMCH. We're talking about the CNIS. So the point is that TMCH provisioning could be, available, a different availability than the CNIS. This is not that much different than any standard registry provisioning system versus resolution. So the hope would be here that this resolution service should be highly available. It shouldn't be that difficult to do so. And that it's somewhat mitigated as well, as Jeff pointed out, is the fact that the majority of the registrations, 70, 80, say 90% of them, will be able to go through even if the CNIS is not up. So the question is that was an acceptable availability for the CNIS resolution service?
Right, and if you think about through the mechanics of the kind of retroactive acceptance, you know, you're talking about after the registrar has presumably billed the registrant for the registration, the registry has collected the information. If the registrant then rejects the claim, you have to introduce whole things about refunds of registration fees. Then you have to talk about how it affects the add grace period and whether those registrations would be, or those deletions would be counted against the allowances in the add grace period. So there are a whole bunch of complications that that introduces that we weren't ready to recommend as a uniform solution. It's possible registries could choose to do that or elect to do that, but I think as far as making a uniform requirement, the more simple approach, again, allowing registries to do some things retroactively, possibly, we think the general rule should be set at if it matches a claim and the CNIS is down, then there should be the registration shouldn't go through.
Okay.
Let's see, I'm looking at the Werner talks about the pending create paradigm is well established. Let us not forget that there may be other reasons than the availability. The registries are likely to institute additional services and protection mechanisms anyway. Should have a basis that provides a scalable basis for them. So look, I think our method, we could allow for it and make it optional, but Werner, then you have to come up with solutions to all of the other issues. You have to come up with solutions to the add grace period, which is a consensus policy. So you have to come up with exceptions to that. You have to come up with how registrars are going to implement it with refunds and all of that other stuff. So, again, I don't object to any of that stuff. I think we can figure that out with pending create, but we can't just say, let's allow the pending create, it's well established. We need to think about those other situations. Right, so I'd really appreciate, it would be great, I know some of the registrars have another meeting they're at this morning, but I think that's an area where it would be good to get registrar feedback on, and not just registry input. So some of the, I'm sorry, Jim, do you have another comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond a little bit to the pending create discussion is the fact that adding pending create to the model is going to add a lot of complexity, especially if a registry supports both real-time creates as well as pending creates. It's not really going to help things out a whole lot, and the basic assumption here is that the CNIS cannot be made highly available, right? So going through and adding a lot of extra complexity of a real-time create versus a pending create and then dealing with all the asynchronous interaction that needs to occur is being done based on the assumption that the CNIS cannot be made highly available.
So I think Jonathan has a comment on there about is an HTTP-based service more challenging, costly to provide than an EPP interface, and what kind of exposure is there in terms of DDoS? Jim, do you have a response to that?
It's related to DDoS. I mean, the actual protocol that's used here, I don't think would be a big variance, other than the fact that actually an EPP-based interface would require authentication, right? So it actually might be more difficult to make that more highly available. If you had a set of read-only in-memory HTTP services providing for the information, that should be relatively straightforward to set up, at least in my opinion.
Okay, thanks, Jim. So we then posted in our document a list of questions that, and some of them were addressed by Tom on the list and others. So I thought I would just reiterate these questions. and then you know, maybe just go a little bit more background into this. The first question we had is, how long after retrieving a notice is it allowed to be accepted for use in a domain name registration? So think about the scenario here where oftentimes during land rush, it's not first come, first serve, at least the beginning of land rush. And so you're faced with a situation where, let's say a registry and .co did this, and I know others did as well, that let's say you collect registrations, maybe you charge a premium rate because it's premium registration for the first 30 days, and then you wait to see if there's any duplicates, and for any duplicate applications, you know, or multiple applications for the same name, you would then auction only those multiple applications, but you would allow all of those to go through if there was only one application. So that's a very common way that's been done in the past. Or you could just do a straight-out auction. So you collect, well, like I said, that is basically the auction mechanism. So what you do there then is if a registrar, when it collects the registration information, it would then run through this claims process. It would see if there's a claim. If there was a claim, it would provide the notice, et cetera. If there wasn't a claim on day one when the registrar applied for it, then what happens on day 30 is, let's say the auction's not even day 30. Let's say the auctions are done 45 days later. Now you potentially could have a scenario where even though there wasn't a claim initially when the registrar applied for the name, there may be a claim that came within those 45 days. So do you then have the registrar recheck to see whether there's a claim right before the auction occurs, or do you check afterwards when the registration would supposedly go through, and then what happens if a registrar has paid multiple thousand dollars for a name when it didn't believe there was a claim, now finds out there was a claim, but is stuck paying the auction provider for the fees that because it won the auction. So it's not an easy question. There have been multiple posts on this of whether you institute something called a, I think Tom called it kind of a retroactive claim service, or whether you just have a requirement that right before the auction is conducted, there has to be yet another check to make sure, or whether it's pretty much buyer beware, right? So the buyer buys it and then it's subject to the claim. I think you know, the last option is probably a scary one for registrants. Or do you basically say, look, in order to have your claim during the land rush be acknowledged or have it part of the claim service, you actually have to have your information into the clearinghouse by X date. Next date is 2 weeks prior to the land rush starting or whatever time period that is. And any claims that come in afterwards or anything entered to the clearinghouse is put on kind of a hold during the rest of the land rush process and then only comes into play during a first-come, first-served process if that's still during the 60 days of general availability that the registry has. So all of those are questions. I know that Jeff Backhouse had commented and some had commented on the list that just set that effective date. If the claims aren't in, it's usually only a 30 to maybe 60-day period. So any new claims that come in to the clearinghouse, so it's pretty much tough luck. You know, you have a date you should have known about, and they didn't get the claim for that name if it was registered during land rush. So I don't know if anyone wants to discuss that now. I'll tell you from my personal viewpoint, instituting at the registry level a retroactive claim service to me is pretty scary and ultimately extremely complex. And I know Tom talked about it as possible service for auction providers or other registrars or other service providers to institute. But from a registry perspective, it makes things incredibly complex. So it's something that we as registries do not want to go down that road. And by the way, I think that was an issue regardless of whether it was the centralized model that we proposed or the decentralized model that was proposed by Deloitte. I think that issue needs to be addressed. And then there's the question, which I think is similar, is how do you deal with pre-registration? So, you know, we know that there's now registries accepting pre-registrations for names well before the claim service is even up, or there'll be a lot of pre-registrations well before there's a connection between the registry and the clearinghouse. That's something that needs to be thought through. I think it's similar to the other question of there needs to be there will need to be a check at some point of those names that were pre-registered against the claims database. When that is a question we need to talk about. Well, I'd be interested actually to hear from the providers because I know that they've had some weeks to talk about it, and really the bulk of the work here, or a lot of the work here, is going to be has to be done by the providers in this different model than what was contemplated. So I don't know if William or Vicky, Jan.
Jeff, this is Karen. I'll just add a little bit on that. I'll just share that we have, since the discussion in Brussels where a centralized system was, discussed quite a bit, we have, internally and with in partnership with the providers, tried to investigate what the impact of that would be in terms of the, the risks, the cost, and the time frame in the project. Obviously it's just estimates. I mean, we did that in advance of getting this claim proposal last week, so it's helpful to have some details around it. But that's what I can say at this point is that we have looked into that direction.
Okay. And is there kind of a time period, or when do you think you'll be able to provide us with some feedback? Obviously, we all need to know. We're all working hard and we're walking down this path. I think most of the registries had talked about this in Brussels, and most of us felt that a centralized model made much more sense for various reasons. And, we really need to know whether this is a feasible model to work forward with. It's our assumption that it will be feasible, and it's our assumption that this will be some sort of centralized model will be able to be implemented. But that's kind of critical to this whole discussion. Most of us don't want to feel like we don't want to waste our time going forward if this is a no way, no how, or if it's a no way, no how with these providers whether a different discussion needs to take place.
Yep, that's understood. And it's, it's taking place in parallel with, these discussions that we're having. So, as quickly as we can, feel like we've done all the due diligence we can do on both of those directions and made sure that we're aware of the implications of the direction that we go.
Okay. Anyone else with any comments on that? So one other issue that's kind of been debated, I know, back and forth on the list, and Jim and Chris have done a lot of emails back and forth, is the effect on the EPP specification that's been proposed. And I'd like to actually recommend that discussion be kind of taken off this list and put more onto the EPP. I don't know if it's on the Proverbs list or where that is, but if that discussion could take place separate and apart from these, I think we need to work out kind of the policy issues, and I think everything else will have to be kind of hashed out with the protocols, with registries, registrars. But I think that's an important discussion that needs to take place, but hopefully separate and apart from these. Tom?
Well, actually, Jeff, I kind of had to butt in there. So I agree and I disagree with you. So, and I did on the list as well. The fact that, yes, when we're getting down to the technical details of the protocol elements and that sort of thing, then obviously that goes to the prog reg. But anything that is impactful of what the process flow would be for the protocols and how it applies to the RFC definitely needs to be brought up on this list as well.
Okay. I think that's fair enough. And so are those, Jim, highlighted in an email as to which of those specific issues kind of separated out?
Say that again. What was that question again?
Is there, or could you then, like, resend an email to the list on, like, those issues separated out, those issues that you think do need to be discussed by the group versus those that are really more protocol impacted?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only one that I really had was that whole auto-create of contact thing. Other than that, I think the majority of everything else can be discussed on prog reg. So,
okay.
Yeah, I don't think we have that much of an issue.
Okay, cool. Tom?
Yeah, Jeff, I just want to make sure I'm clear on what the registry's position is on claims during land rush. And it sounds like you'd like to say that there's an effective date before which a claim needs to be active in order for it to basically have validity during a land rest process. And if it misses that effective date, then it doesn't have validity during land rest. Is that right?
Well, I think it's part of it. I think it may be different for each registry. So for a registry that does a land rest that's purely on a first-come, first-served basis, I don't think you need necessarily an effective date because either it's there at the time of registration or it's not, right? I think for registries that run some sort of batching land rush where names are collected, applications are collected in advance, and there's some sort of contention process or some sort of batch process, I think that's right. I think there would need to be an effective date. And some registries are going to do a hybrid, so you may do the first 30 days in that kind of batching type process, but the next 30 days you'll do as a first-come, first-serve. So the effective date would be important for the first 30 days, but wouldn't be important for the next 30 days. And some registries, frankly, are going to do claims for a year, 2 years, or even the whole time. So, again, for when it's real-time, first-come, first-serve registration, I don't think an effective date is important. But when it's not real time, I think that's when it does become important.
Okay. And as a follow-up, Jeff, if there is an effective date, then that means if the domain name, say, is allocated at an auction 2 or 3 weeks after that effective date, then the registry, when checking to see if that new domain name is subject to a claim, would only look at claims that were valid before the effective date, and under that scenario would only notify the clearinghouse if it filed a claim valid before that effective date.
So I think that is, I think that's right, although I'm just thinking about the scenario in which the registry was actually checking at the time that it received the application as opposed to at the time that the name was actually registered. In other words, right?
Well, the problem with that is it doesn't know who's getting the domain name yet. And so if there is a claim, then the clearinghouse won't be able to tell the trademark owner who the domain name was allocated to.
Well, I'm not sure that that's, I think the registry would check multiple times across the same name, right? Because if it knows that there's going to be an auction, the presumption is that one of them will get it. And if it's checked all of those, the registry has done its part. You have to separate that issue from notifying the clearinghouse when there's actually a registration. So when there's actually a registration, the registry will be able to send that in the NORN information, it'll send to the clearinghouse saying, this name was registered, It was checked against the claims database on this date, and was not this IP address, this client IP address, acknowledged it at this time, and would have the acknowledgement.
And it, it could only be done for actual registrations or applications that were presented the claims notice. I think that was one of the big items on the list. Fundamentally, I don't think it's a good idea for the registry to pass off information in that notice if the registrant wasn't, in fact, presented with the claims notice.
Yes, correct. But I'm not sure why that's a conflict with what I said.
No, the reason why was that if the actual the application came through, and let's say that there were no claims at the time, right, and then later on there were other ones that did, and they did have a claims notice, and then the one that actually wound up getting it was the registrant that was not presented the claims notice, right?
Well, I think what we decided was that there would be an effective date in those certain circumstances. So in other words, to participate, the registry would have a rule basically saying to participate in LandRush, you will have to have all of your claims information in by X date, and that X date was 2 weeks prior to when you started the LandRush. So
okay, okay, fair enough.
So it's kind of uniformly applied.
Yeah, you're right.
So, Tom, I think that's the way it would be handled.
Yeah, makes sense.
Any other questions? Obviously, all of this needs to be reviewed with the rights holders and the rest of the community, frankly, registrars, registrants. I'd still like to get more comments on the list. I know Chris is working hard to produce another draft to go out very soon with the comments that have already been received. And we'd like to get this document out to the community after next week's call. So any feedback from the providers would be great if we could have some of that prior to it. And then, Karen, you and I should discuss and talk about next week for the call the mechanics of actually getting this out to everyone.
Sure. Yeah, we can do that.
And then is there any, maybe we can talk about this next time, but is there any plans that are in place now for, I know there's sessions on the clearinghouse in Toronto. Is there any kind of plans to discuss this model with the community?
So in terms of what's on the schedule for Toronto, there is a, there's the usual update session, general session, which we kind of envision being in two halves. The first on the provisioning side on how trademark data gets submitted and verified, and the work that's been done on that. And then the second half would be focusing on the registry side. And then I did put in a request for a working session just on Sunrise and claims, along the lines of the discussions that we had in Brussels and on the list. So just to focus on that, and that should be on the schedule as well.
Okay. Then it may also be worth kind of exploring another face-to-face after Toronto to take some of the feedback that we've had and, work further on operational or work further on the requirements.
I think we can look at that once we see where we are.
Yeah, I mean, I think working on that now might help just so we can get it on people's calendars. I mean, if we don't need it and we decide in Toronto we don't need it, we could always kind of cancel it. But I think working on it now would help us to get a location. And I know that's one of the hardest parts is getting a location, getting people's schedules freed up and reserved. So working on it now might help.
Got it.
And Karen, do you have a proposed time frame for that working session or a day that might occur?
It's on Monday, I believe. late in the day. I don't think the final schedule is out, but last I saw it was Monday afternoon.
Are we how long? What kind of duration are we talking about this meeting? I just want to understand whether or not I should make a trip or not.
Yeah, it's I think it's 2 hours.
2 hours.
Yep.
Come on, Jim. It's Toronto. It's not that far for you. You can drive there.
I know. I just need to go up my organization and request to go.
Well, I appreciate everyone's input on this and reading these drafts, and it'd be great to get some more feedback in writing so we can include it in the next version. We have seen all the comments that have come in, so if I didn't address it in this call, we will address it, and we'll get a transcript of these chat comments here, and we listen to this call. And have a call. The plan is to have a call same time next week, same day. So hopefully everyone can make it. And Karen, I don't know if you have any closing words.
No, but I think it's actually on Tuesday next week. Is that?
Oh, did I say Tuesday?
Correct.
I don't remember. Sorry.
Yeah. It's the 25th is what I had.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. My fault. 25th. You're right. Tuesday, so that's just in a few days.
Yep.
So we're going to try to get out a draft by no later than Monday and point out the changes. 25th, not the 27th, 25th. Thank you, Kev. Any other closing remarks anyone has?
Jeff, it's Jonathan. Just checking what if any plans Karen and or I can have got to. I mean, my concern is we got this road and that we get in some way vetoed by another strongly influential portion of the community, and obviously the most likely candidate for that is the IP community. So these ideas being sort of formally socialized with the IP community and tested against their acceptance of them is critical to their broad-based acceptance. I wonder what plans there are for that.
Well, the question is directed to me. I mean, these proposals are, from this group within the community that's been participating here. And as Jeff has mentioned, there are things that we've indicated that we think would need a broader stakeholder discussion. So that's how we see that happening, is that to the extent that there are proposals developed that we want people to consider, we would begin those discussions to engage that way.
And Karen, if I could just jump in too, Jeff. I think it's going to be incumbent upon us to, I mean, with ICANN's help in distributing the proposal, I think we're going to have to do some outreach on our own. And I think that, I know I've already reached out to some members of the IP community. I think we should all make a concerted effort to, if we're all behind this proposal, is to make sure that the right people are involved and that they're paying attention. ICANN can do so much with, making sure the document goes to all the appropriate lists, but I think some of it's incumbent upon us.
All right, I think fundamentally the question is that how do we get to a single model proposal, right? We had two separate models that we're discussing, and at some point we need to, as a team, say this is kind of the candidate that could go to the community and say this is the model that we are proposing, and let's adjust things where it needs to be adjusted. How do we get to that?
So that one I might throw back onto ICANN and the providers, because I think the key constituency of that, I mean, I'm not so worried about the intellectual property holders. I think that we can work their concerns into our model. I think the key group is right now, frankly, on this phone that we haven't heard too much from, which we need to hear from, which is the providers. If the providers can do it, which we're all urging, then I think we've kind of worked towards this single model. The last thing I want, and I know Jim, this is kind of your point too, is we don't want to be blindsided by the providers in Toronto saying, well, this is just a registry proposal, but we can't do it, and we're not doing it this way. So that's key to me. So, Karen, that's something I'd like. I don't know if you can give us more feedback on Tuesday with the providers, but that's what I see as a fundamental component. We can work on the IP concerns and other concerns.
And now that we need to work on all the details related to when we get to a single model, like all the stuff that, some of the stuff that we're discussing here, right?
I don't know if there's Karen, if you want to comment.
Sorry, I'm not sure I got the question.
How do we get to a single model? I guess that's the question. So we have two alternate models. We haven't formally documented. We've been discussing them. At some point as a team, we need to get to a single model, start going through the detailed issues with whatever the model is. So what is the process by which we can get to a single model?
So the here's how I understand it. You know, you all are working on developing these proposals and then plan to have a broader discussion on them. You know, I don't want to predict what the outcome of that will be, but I think that will be a pretty strong indicator of the direction that we go. And then you once you have that, then you go forward with the set of issues that direction implies.
So what time frame are we talking about here? Are we talking about the Toronto meeting, or when is it that we would get to a point where we can say, yeah, that's the model, that's it?
Well, again, I don't want to try to predict that. I think that we're all especially keen to nail down requirements so that we can build and so that, you know, the registries and registrars can prepare and all of that. I think that really Toronto is key in seeing what the common ground is, and seeing what direction that we can go. Certainly I don't want to see it go much farther than that.
So one thing I would ask of this particular group that's on the call and on the list, and I'll send out that, is I'd like to know from, I know there's some details that need to be worked out, and I know that there's a couple of things here and there, but I'd like to know from people on this call and people on the list as to whether they believe where this alternate proposal is something that they could stand behind, or whether they prefer the Deloitte model that was put out there as well. So I think it would be good when we do put this out for comment is to say, hey, look, this is an alternate model, but this is the model that is at least at a high level supported by all of these parties with more details to be worked out, but essentially this is the right path. So I don't know if anyone that hasn't spoken would like to kind of speak up, but and I've seen some comments. And I see William has put, I suspect the answer would imply the need to provide an alternative. Well, I mean, from our perspective, at least from the registries that were present in Brussels, and from the feedback we've gotten so far, we put this alternate model together because we didn't think we could live with or didn't want to live with the Deloitte model that was proposed. So, I mean, that's pretty clear from, I'll say, Newstar's perspective, and I think I could safely say from the others that put this document together that the model that was proposed by Deloitte was not the model we think that was beneficial for the community, nor was it the one that would be the better solution to implement. And I think that's important to get on the record.
Yeah, and VeriSign backs that position as well.
And I know, I'll say, I know ARI did as well, and Command Media that helped us put the model out. So, I mean, I think that's a key question. I think we need to, if people could provide feedback on the list, because if our proposal is just being presented as, quote, an alternate proposal that was proposed by a few people, it's not going to have much weight. If we can then go out, assuming this is the case, if we can go out and say, this model is proposed by this whole slate of registries that participated, that's going to have much more of an impact, if, in fact, that's true. So it would be great to get others to weigh in. And again, from my perspective, you know, if there is a large contingent that's in favor of this, what we're now calling alternate model, then I would think it would be pretty hard for ICANN to and the providers to ignore. And if they, you know, so that's my own general opinion.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. Is there any other closing comments from anyone? If not, then we'll talk to you next week. I will send the recording around shortly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much.
Bye. Okay.